Who's that coming down the stairs with a beer?
It's Jochen Krauss.
It is Jochen, okay. Good, sir. And is that an astray ball?
People say yes.
You know how to turn it on? I'm sure you do.
No, of course not. It's fine. Yeah, no, because I don't want to knock your... They move it afterwards anyway. We'll give them a minute or two. Excuse me carrying my bag, but they lock our doors now. You can't get back in. Even with your car, you have to suppose. Sort of port knock stuff. And they used to be very, very up and down. They've done a kind of refurbishment, which is great. Are you having any time for questions afterwards?
Yes. Gather there's no lecture coming in afterwards.
There is?
Oh, I was told there wasn't.
So, unless I'm wrong, is it 7:30?
If there is, I'll...
No, anyway, you move outside. No, it's Africa on the Rise. It's the Robert Rothberg one and the other lecture theatre. But people will leave.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's fine. Don't feel under pressure.
Last year I finished it, whatever it was.
And then we had to move people out in again. No,
you've got a bit of time. This
year I've got 5 minutes. Yeah, absolutely.
It's more important I've got one longer lecture than the other.
No, that's good. It's actually, I thought Africa on the Rise was here, but it's not. Just an LT2. You know him, do you? Is it Rothberg?
I do.
Okay, let's start. This is not a good system for a short person. Good evening, everyone. Not turning the lights off just because it's detective fiction. Welcome to the 64th Summer School and to this course with criminal intent, reading detective fiction. Professor Colin Bundy, who will be giving the course, has been reading, enjoying and thinking about detective fiction and crime novels for many years. As you will all know, he's a distinguished historian, biographer and commentator on South African political developments, and his observation of cause and effect, of the relationships between the great figures of history and the influential undertow of ordinary life, and of the elusive rhythms of national life, have surely led him to have a special interest in whodunit. Now retired from his important positions in universities in the UK and South Africa, as the first principal of Green Templeton College, University of Oxford, as Vice-Chancellor of the University of Witwatersrand, as Principal of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, perhaps he has a little more time to consider hard-boiled and soft-boiled fictional crime in South African novels as well as elsewhere, rather than the achievements or crimes of history. Hard to believe, though, when we know that he has just completed a short biography of Governor Mbeki for Jacana, and is busy finalizing another publication called Shortchanged, South Africa Since Apartheid, which, by the way, grew out of his summer school lectures here last year, which I'm sure many of you attended. This book will appear in March. Colin is also a trustee of the Canon Collins Trust and president of the Oxford Centre of the National Trust and the Oxford branch of the Royal Commonwealth Society. You hear a lot of Oxford there. Not only his writing experience, but all that institutional experience will, of course, have stood him in good stead as a lead investigator of detective fiction. We know that universities, heritage organizations, and scholarly societies, not only the South African Felt, not to mention Oxford itself, are key sites for devious characters to commit heinous crimes. I leave you then, not with Colonel Mustard, but with Professor Bundy in the library. Please welcome.
I'm just going to turn it off to England. I just want to turn it off. But I may need it, I'm warned.
Then you can bring it back.
Okay. Ingrid, thank you very much indeed for that. Technological footnote, if this mic, the lapel mic, fades, which apparently it has done in the past, will you, particularly those at the back, warn me and I'll switch across to that one. In 1948, the poet W.H. Auden wrote an essay called The Guilty Vicarage, and he began it with a confession. And I'm quoting, "For me, as for many others, the reading of detective stories is an addiction, like tobacco or alcohol." So let me make the same admission. I am a fellow addict. Indeed, I was hooked very young. I began reading detective stories as a schoolboy and did so voraciously, uncritically, and indiscriminately. Sherlock Holmes was an early favorite. Shall I put the other mic on? Okay. Thanks very much. Is that better?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. Sherlock Holmes, I was saying, was an early favourite. And then I read all the Rex Stark, Agatha Christie, Niall Marsh, and others that the Grahamstown Public Library carried. And then at university, first as a student, and then as an academic, the habit persisted. Crime fiction, I suppose, in those years was an escape from more demanding texts. It was a slightly guilty leisure pursuit. It was short of a hobby, but very much part of my life. And then as the years went by, I began reading more selectively. I would discover a new author, develop an enthusiasm, and read him or her obsessively. So I had an Ed McBain phase. Now that lasted a while because there are 55 novels in the 87th Precinct series. I binged on other American authors like Raymond Chandler, John MacDonald, Patricia Highsmith, and Elmore Leonard. In the 1970s, I waited greedily for every new James McClure novel, which I'm talking about on Thursday. In the 1980s, I read P.D. James, Colin Dexter, Ruth Rendell, Robert B. Parker. But the last 20 years or so have been quite exceptional. We addicts could get our fix with Aurelio Zen in Italy, Dave Robicheaux in Louisiana, John Rebus in Edinburgh, Kurt Wallander in Sweden, Jean-Baptiste Adamsberg in Paris, Harry Holler in Oslo, and many, many other locations of some fine detective fiction. We could be turned on by a new generation of female detectives. Kinsey Mulhone, V.I. Wachowski, Kate Ivory, Sam Falconer, or in this parish, Claire Hutt. Now, over the last few years, although I've never tried to kick the habit, I have become a bit more self-conscious, more reflective about it, more curious as to exactly why these books have given me so much pleasure for so long. And so I began to read about the history, the development, and the diversity of the genre. And that's where these five lectures come from. Lifelong reading, and then in recent years, trying to think a little bit more systematically about what it is that I am reading. More importantly, where are they going? What should you expect? To begin with, let me just note that there's been a massive growth of critical interest, scholarly interest, in the genre of crime fiction. And that's partly because ever since the 1960s, an older distinction between highbrow and lowbrow, or serious and popular fiction, has simply been dismantled. And literary theorists, literary critics nowadays, engage energetically with forms of popular culture, including detective fiction. Theorists of narrative were the first in the 1960s to analyze the detective story in detail. Umberto Eco, Georges Borges, Roland Barthes, all of the great European critics of the second half of the 20th century have written on detective stories. They tended to explore the underlying structure of the narrative, the rules that govern the way these stories work, as well as the techniques of the authors and the assumptions of the readers. In the 1970s and especially 1980s, criticism concerned itself particularly with the ideological function of detective stories. In other words, they asked not only about attitudes towards crime, descriptions of wrongdoing, but also what values and norms are embedded in the detective stories you read. What messages or reassurances do they provide to you, their readers? Most detective fiction, according to that generation of theorists, most detective fiction serves to uphold law and order, to ensure social and cultural stability. More recently, however, there's been a much more diverse approach to crime fiction theoretically. And the idea that detective fiction has a fixed, stable, uniform ideological position has retreated. And contemporary analysis is much more seized with issues around diversity, postmodernity, postcolonial themes, etc., in detective writing. Now, I am not approaching detective fiction as a literary theorist. That's not my field. And my lectures don't draw primarily on theoretical approaches. But because I've been reading them, there are going to be echoes of some of these where they've influenced my understanding. My own approach is less ambitious. I am interested, firstly, in the history of the format, how it developed and changed over time, and how these changes related to broader historical changes. How detective fiction echoed or mirrored or tracked the real world. Secondly, I'm going to try to say something about the extraordinary flexibility and adaptability of the genre. How an apparently rigid and limited formula has given rise to infinite variations. And then thirdly, I remain convinced that crime fiction is a genre which most clearly and immediately represents society back to itself. I don't mean, please, that crime novels are a mirror of the time and place in which they set. They are not a realist account, but they are written in a particular context. They serve as a device to illuminate bits of society, to exaggerate this aspect, ignore the other, but in so doing, helping one think about that time and that place. Crime fiction is quite remarkably responsive to changing social and cultural concerns. I think this will become quite vividly and immediately apparent when we talk about South African crime fiction towards the end of this series. The ability of detective stories to speak about and to speak to these concerns about society, is one of the reasons for its enduring popularity as a literary genre. Now, how does one describe or categorize what I'm talking about? Some people use the term detective fiction, as I did when I submitted the proposal for this course. I realized when I was writing them, I tend more frequently to say crime fiction, but I'm going to use detective fiction and crime fiction interchangeably. Quite a lot of Americans talk about mystery fiction, same thing. The genre, okay, thank you.
Could you speak in there and the microphone's here?
I think the microphone's pointing the wrong way.
That way.
He's going to come and help me make a point in front of you. I'm very aware I'm trying to speak out of the corner of my mouth into the mic. Could we have the mic in front of you? It's all Ingrid's fault. Okay, can we move this way? And now towards me. Okay. All righty. We're in business, thanks. The genre as a whole, and this is a very, very simple definition, as economic as it is accurate, the genre involves a narrative with a crime, a criminal, and an investigator, deliberately written for a popular audience. Deliberately written for as wide an audience as possible. Within that broad definition, there are obviously different kinds of detective fiction, subgenres, and I'm concerned with three in particular. The clue puzzle, which I'll be talking about in detail in a moment, the private eye or the hard-boiled detective story, and the police procedural or police novel. And those are the subject of tomorrow night's lecture. Then there are others, subgenres that many of you will read but that I'm not discussing in this course. The crime novel or psychothriller, not so much a whodunit as why done it. The spy thriller, John le Carré, the thriller of violence, Silence of the Lambs, that kind of thing, all, I think, recognizable within the broad category. But tonight, I'm looking at a massively successful subgenre, the form taken by detective fiction in its golden age. And I'm following other critics in calling this form the clue puzzle, to distinguish it from other sorts that come later. And its presiding mistress is, of course, Agatha Christie. Now, when and why did this new form emerge? By the 1870s, other kinds of crime writing were well established in France, Britain, the United States, and elsewhere, short stories usually featuring policemen rather than detectives. And in 1887, there was a major moment in the history of crime fiction, the publication in Beaton's Christmas Annual of the first Sherlock Holmes story, Arthur Conan Doyle. When Dr. John Watson moved into 221B Baker Street and narrated the first of over 60 cases featuring his co-lodger, who reveals on page 2 that he is a consulting detective, a new format is created. In the hands of Conan Doyle, the archetypal detective suddenly existed, highly intelligent, essentially moral, somewhat elitist, all-knowing, energetic, and eccentric. And you can think just how many subsequent detectors follow that mould. Holmes remains the best known of all fictional sleuths, and he casts an influential shadow over the genre. Doyle's stories consolidated public appreciation of the mode, the public's liking for, the expectations of, and their familiarity with the genre. They also established, the Holmes stories established narrative patterns and conventions that shaped the fiction I'm talking about in a moment in the Golden Age. Many of the detectives have an assistant who is often, but not always, the narrator. A crime is committed early on in the tale. It is retrospectively reconstructed, told how it worked. And then there's a crucial part played in its solution by logic, intelligence, and reason. Little grey cells of a subsequent detective. The Golden Age of detective fiction is normally taken for the interwar years, 1918 to 1939. Although, of course, many writers continued to write recognizably clue puzzles after World War II. A couple of features worth mentioning. Before 1918, almost all detective fiction was written in short story format, like the Sherlock Holmes stories. But the great bulk of Golden Age crime translated into novels. Short stories lingered on, but the novel became the typical, the dominant vehicle for crime fiction. And this meant that the author could handle a larger cast of characters, could devise more elaborate methods of murder, and give ample space to the spectacular solutions and denouement. Secondly, the advent of these novels, The Golden Age, 1918 to 39, saw a dramatic gender shift. They were produced, in England especially, by a new generation of women writers. And they were consumed by a new generation of female readers. The new lending libraries circulated high volumes of popular fiction, and 75% of their readers were women. In England, the clue puzzle was dominated by what P.D. James, a contemporary female crime writer, has called four formidable women: Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Naomi Marsh, and Marjorie Allingham. But there were many others writing then who are less read today: Patricia Wentworth, Josephine Tay, Gladys Mitchell. Jessica Mann has written a little book called Deadlier Than the Male, and she says that, quote, these respectable English women are so good at murder. The novels themselves evolved quite quickly into an instantly recognizable formula. They featured centrally a detective who might be freelance or amateur, like Poirot, like Lord Peter Wimsey or Albert Campion, Marjorie Allingham, or they might be a police officer, as in the Michael Innes or Naomi Marsh novels. But in all cases, whether policeman or freelance, a detective of unusual cerebral power. Each detective, in turn, was involved for the length of the novel with a finite group of people whom one might call the characters, although they're pretty two-dimensional in some of these books, but whose actual function in the story was that they comprised the victim, the suspects, and the perpetrator. And you know as you read through that this group includes the perpetrator. All characters are potential suspects. It transpires that many of them have possible motives, that they conceal secrets, and that their alibis are unreliable. The suspects are typically drawn from the same social stratum, an upper middle class. And in order to keep the number of suspects finite, the murder often takes place within a conveniently limiting locale, the country house, the small island, the Nile River steamer, a single carriage of the Orient Express, an opera crew, and so on and on. And then finally, and absolutely central to this subgenre, the narrative is strewn with clues. A frequently intricate plot is rendered more intriguing by a series of clues to be recognized by the eagle-eyed detective, but equally importantly by the alert reader. For another feature of the clue puzzle as crime fiction was that it established a new role for readers. They were invited implicitly to become the detective, to solve the crime, to name the murderer, in utter safety, at home, snuggled up in bed. The implication was that the cunningly detailed plots could be solved, that all the clues available to the detective were available to the reader. Well, yes and no. Of course the clues are sprinkled through every book, but some of them are identified as clues. Ooh, here's a clue, a scrap of burnt paper, a piece of material, a missing coffee cup. And the detective draws attention to these clues. But there are plenty of other clues hidden in the text. These are details mentioned by the author, noticed by the detective, but probably skipped over by you, the reader. Take one example from Agatha Christie. She makes a bit of a fuss about a date on the diary, on a calendar hanging up, and the butler finally comes over and adjudicates, no, it was definitely on the 13th. And that seems incredibly important to the plot. But the clue is that the butler had to come up close to see the date. He's very short-sighted. And that discounted evidence he'd given earlier on. Some of the clues assist the detective. Some mislead the detective. Others are there simply to mislead the reader. These are false clues designed to throw the reader off the scent, like the smoked fish dragged across the trail of hunting dogs, the original red herrings. The prominence of clues in these books gave rise to a set of expectations and rules, and a British crime novelist put them... I should have put that up earlier, that's what I've just said. Here are Ronald Knox's 10 commandments for detective stories. He also, with Dorothy Sayers, founded a detective club, and authors who joined this club had to take this oath. Do you solemnly swear never to conceal a vital clue from the reader? Do you promise to observe a seemly moderation in the use of gangs, conspiracies, death rays, ghosts, hypnotism, trapdoors, Chinamen, again, and utterly and forever to forswear mysterious poisons unknown to science? Now, obviously, Sayers and Knox are being mock serious, and they're being playful. But under this play, under these rules, was a very serious conviction that authors should stick to the rules, that fair play should be observed. And this was taken seriously by the readership at large. And for this reason, because of these expectations of fair play, that in 1926, when Agatha Christie published The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, it created such a storm. Now, some of you may wish to read, who doesn't know who killed Roger Ackroyd? Good, there's a treat for you waiting to film. Today, this book regularly appears on lists of the most influential, the most significant crime novels ever written. One of her biographers calls it the supreme, the ultimate detective novel. It rests upon the most elegant of all twists. It puts the whole concept of detective fiction on an armature and sculpts it into a dazzling new shape. Unquote. But when it appeared, when that shape became clear, many readers and many reviewers felt that its innovative twist, its imaginative ending, had broken the rules. And it, in fact, does break one of these. I'm going to return to the clue puzzle as a whole in a moment and mention some of the ways in which other people have explained its popularity and its influence. But let me look at a couple of examples first. And inescapably, I begin with Agatha Christie. It's impossible to overstate her significance for this kind of detective writing, the clue puzzle. Not only did she write 66 detective novels in a career that ran over 40 years, she did more early on than any other author to create and codify the subgenre, to define it, to delimit its the way it worked. And commentators have for a long time recognized her technical skills, the ingenuity of her plotting, the subtlety of her deceptions, and her ability to wring new surprises from a simple formula. More than this, Agatha Christie in the 1920s and 30s, as Doyle had in the 1980s and 90s, caught the moment, harvested its possibilities, and distilled out of them a new mode of crime fiction. And in 1920, Agatha Christie launched herself and Hercule Poirot into the history of 20th century popular culture. She actually completed the story in 1917. The manuscript floated around, was turned down by several publishers, and the young woman eventually signed a contract that earned her £25. The book was The Mysterious Affair at Styles, and it remains, I think, one of her most satisfying works, partly because she spent a long, long time writing it. And when she wrote it, she drew on her own reading of crime fiction. She was a great Sherlock Holmes devotee. And she tried to create a new whole, a puzzle story which is solely that. Don't forget, Conan Doyle is still publishing Sherlock Holmes stories in 1920. He had tried to kill his detective on the Reichenbach Falls, but public pressure made him bring him back. And the young Christie copied a key feature. Dr. Watson had been injured in Afghanistan when he first met Holmes, and on the first page of The Mysterious Affair at Styles, we meet Captain John Hastings, who's been invalided home from the front. The book is actually set during World War I. Hastings is a dimmer, more plodding version of Watson. But like Watson, he tells the story. As it happens, and I think fortunately, not deep into her oeuvre, Christie pensioned him off. She got tired of Hastings and dispatched him to Argentina. She brought him back for one last novel called Curtain, where he and Poirot re-meet at Styles, at this house. Immediately, Hastings and the reader are plunged into the uneasy setting of Styles' court, a house. Here's an elderly matriarch who has just married Albert Inglethorpe, an absolute outsider. Anyone can see that. He's got a great black beard and wears patent leather boots in all weathers, says one of his stepsons. Here are the two Cavendish stepsons. One of them is married to the delectable Mary, a wild, untamed spirit in an exquisitely civilized body. Here is the old lady's companion. Where is she? A lady in a stout tweed skirt. Here is her protege, Cynthia, living at the house because she's been left an orphan and penniless. She's a fresh young creature, full of life and vigor. And she happens to work in the hospital dispensary, handling poisons every day. And here is the mysterious Dr. Baustein, a tall, bearded man, quote, who is one of the greatest living experts on poisons. and a friend of Mary Cavendish, the young wife. On his first evening in the house, Hastings experienced a vague suspicion of everyone and everything, a premonition of approaching evil. Unquote. What prescience! For a week later, old Mrs. Inglethorpe is found murdered, poisoned. Fortunately, on the very afternoon of that dreadful event, Hastings met up by sheer chance with an acquaintance. He had mentioned him casually to Mary Cavendish on his first day at Stiles. I came across a man in Belgium once, a very famous detective. He was a marvellous little man. A few pages later, he tells somebody else about him. He was a funny little man, a great dandy, but wonderfully clever. Now, leaving the village post office, Hastings, quote, cannoned into a little man who was leaving. They do go on about how little he is. And of course it is Hercule Poirot. Quote, Poirot was an extraordinary looking little man. He was hardly more than 5 feet 4 inches, but he carried himself with great dignity. His head was exactly the shape of an egg. Unquote. Poirot, we learn, is one of a group of Belgian refugees housed in the village, and the Cavendish brothers agreed to Hastings' suggestion that he be brought into the house to investigate the mysterious affair. Poirot does exactly that for the next 9 chapters. Until, as the final chapter is headed, Poirot explains. We need not tonight accompany Hastings through this account, plodding away diligently a few steps behind the Belgian detective. Nor need we take note of all the clues so liberally distributed and usually misconstrued by the stolid Englishman. But if we were to do so, look at the details of the plot, we'd quickly discover that Stiles Court is awash with tensions and secrets. Why was Mary Cavendish so friendly with Dr. Baustein? What lay between Lawrence Cavendish and Cynthia? What exactly were Albert Inglethorpe's dealings with the pretty young woman of gypsy type, glimpsed in the first chapter? Who wore the black beard that had been taken out of the dressing up box? Why was there a fire in the grate on one of the warmest days of the summer? And so on. The police become involved, they make an arrest, a trial is started, but they've got the wrong man. The solution that Poirot finally delivers will still surprise, I venture to say, most readers. It is a wickedly ingenious murder unmasked by a surpassingly clever detective. So, as in so many other clue puzzles, an unpleasant episode is brought to a close. The lovers are reunited. Law, order, and property are secure. And in a universe that is forever threatening to escape our rational grasp, a single little man with a maniacal penchant for neatness leaves us the gift of a tidy world. Christie had achieved in her first detective novel all the elements of the formula that was to serve her so well. A rather different kind of read, although still within the conventions established by Christie, is provided by Dorothy Sayers. She has probably divided readers and critics more than any other British crime writer. As P.D. James points out, to her admirers, she is the writer who did more than any other to make the detective story intellectually respectable and to change it from an ingenious but sub-literary puzzle into a specialized branch of fiction with serious claims to be judged a novel. To her detractors, she is outrageously snobbish, intellectually arrogant, pretentious, and occasionally dull. Elizabeth George, a Californian woman who today writes detective stories herself, is an admirer. And she argues that Dorothy Sayers constantly pressed against the limits, the confining limits of the genre. She saw the crime and its ensuing investigation as merely the framework for a much larger story. And Sayers certainly explores landscape, character, ethical and philosophical issues in far greater depth than most of her Golden Age peers. Sayers did not write down to her readers. Rather, she assumed that her readers would rise to her expectations of them. She herself, as she looks, was a formidable intellectual, a classicist, a theologian, a poet and playwright. Her English translation of Dante's Divine Comedy is still highly regarded and in print. And she turned to detective stories partly to make money. At the time when she began, she was working in an advertising agency, see fourth novel in the Whimsy series, Murder Must Advertise, but partly also because she believed that the crime novel should aim higher, could become a novel of manners. Now, if it's true, and I think it is, that some readers love and others loathe her, they would tend to be divided by the persona of her detective, Lord Peter Whimsy. We meet Whimsy in the first of her novels, Whose Body? Whose Body is, like so many of the Sayers books, got a very clunky crime and a rather hard-to-believe criminal. But for Sayers, that hardly matters. That's a peg on which to introduce us to Peter Whimsy, who does matter to her, to other characters, and to create a sense of London in that time and place. Lord Peter is aristocratic, goes without saying, he's foppish, he's fastidious. He conceals his intellect by a flow of facetious chatter, interspersed with many, many quotations. Beneath his bland manner and his oh-so-comfortable lifestyle, he's actually a troubled, deeply moral character. And that emerges over and over again in the Whimsy novels. Whimsy has two main allies, two people who help him detect. One is a professional policeman, Peter Parker, of whom Sayers approves so much that she eventually marries him off to Whimsy's sister. The other, and I find him a bit difficult in the books, is the scarcely credible Mr. Mervyn Bunter, Whimsy's valet, the complete gentleman's gentleman. Bunter can bid successfully at auctions for rare books as easily as he can chat up a cook or a housemaid to gain inside knowledge for his employer. I'm quoting, he's an expert on photography and fingerprints and can advise his master on the proper occasion to wear his mauve tie or serve Coburn 80 port. He has the scientific skills of a trained criminologist, the unerring eye of an expensive gentleman's tailor, and the discretion of a sage. He combines all these faculties with the hauteur of an archbishop and the conversational style of the later Henry James. That's an American critic. The other major character in the Whimsy books is Harriet Vane. He first meets her when she's on trial for murder. This is in the novel Strong Poison. She's been wrongly accused of the murder. And Whimsy saves her by solving the case. He falls in love with her. He makes, I don't know, somebody's counted them, 38 proposals, I think, right through the novels. He finally marries her in a book I will be discussing on Wednesday night, Gaudy Nights. And she becomes a kind of co-sleuth in Busman's Holiday, Busman's Honeymoon. It would be wrong to define Harriet Vane simply by her relations with Whimsy. She's actually an extremely interesting feminist heroine who's as serious about life, literature, and religion as is Dorothy Sayers. But what are we to make of this formula, this type of detective story, the clue puzzle novel? Why did so many people read them so avidly? How do they satisfy their readers? What do they tell us about the period between the two world wars? At first glance, they seem to reveal very little indeed of their social and historical context. And a long line of criticism has pointed out how cloistered a view of the interwar years they provide. There is no general strike or Great Depression, nor mass unemployment in Christie, Sayers and the others. There's no rise of Bolshevism or fascism. What we encounter instead is a decorous, circumspect, well-spoken middle class and its members frequently living in an idealized, generic village. In Christie, in particular, there's a stock set of characters to be encountered from one novel to the next. Wealthy widows, maiden ladies, vicars, lawyers, doctors, retired army officers. They play bridge and garden and go to church. They approve of self-help, self-control, and capital punishment. They disapprove of socialism, the modern woman, and contemporary literature. They employ servants, but servants play very little part in the plots and are almost bereft of character. In the mysterious affair at Stiles, we meet the parlourmaid. Says a critic, she is simply and suitably named Dorcas, with neither a family or a face. Christie and Sayers not only focused on the upper middle class, but also faithfully reflected its prejudices. They are class-bound, anti-Semitic, and generally hostile to foreigners. And so, in their characters and their social settings, the Clue puzzle detective stories were conservative, defensive. And it is sometimes suggested that that was their implicit function for their readers, one of reassurance, putting wickedness in its place, restoring the world to a bland social harmony. Well, yes, but that is only part of the story. That's a limited reading of how these books work. Certainly, the characters are drawn from a single social stratum, but this means that the murderer is also from that stratum. He or she is one of us, not an outsider. And this is one of the secrets of Agatha Christie's success. Stiles Court, that fine old house, turns out to be a nest of jealousies and secrets, and in book after book, she conveys this sense of unease and danger in the most domestic of settings. Betrayal in Christie is personal. In one of these houses, you can trust no one at all. Christie's criminals are thus traitors to the class and the world so calmly described. And I think that's where they become rather more unsettling. The Clue puzzle flourished between the wars. As Europe recovered from the carnage and devastation of one world war and entered into an inexorable slide into the outbreak of a second. And I think it's very important to consider how that context affected these detective fictions. Some have argued that after the horrors of war, readers simply sought relaxation, and the popularity of the Clue puzzle is seen as analogous to the crossword puzzle, which is also born in the 1920s. Others see a darker relationship between war and these novels. For Gillian Plain, a British critic, Christie's corpses played on anxieties about the bodies of World War I. Interwar fiction thus both reveals and offers a sacrifice to ameliorate the wounds of war. Alison Light, another critic, identifies the Golden Age crime fiction as, and I think it's a very telling phrase, a literature of convalescence. Like the soldiers in Wilfred Owen's poem, Insensibility, the luckiest had seen too much red and were rid of its hurt forever. The rest longed for an anesthetic. And these books are studied with women who are widows or have been abandoned, lost their men at the front. Miss Marple's, one of Christie's own detectives, was engaged to a man who died in the Somme. Whodunits were not meant to be cathartic, but to relieve generalized anxiety. An American critic reads Dorothy Sayers in the same way. One of the Whimsy stories, I quite like it, The Unpleasantness of the Belladonna Club, captures, I'm reading from the critic, captures some of the dreadful sadness and suffering of England after World War I, where an entire generation was profoundly and horribly damaged by war. Everyone in the novel constantly alludes to that war, which never stops happening for them, and everyone seems psychologically or physically afflicted by the terrors of the recent past, unquote. Now, Lord Peter Whimsy himself suffered from neurasthenia, from shell shock, in whose body he has a kind of little mini breakdown. He can hear the sappers in the tunnels next to him, and he calls out, and Bunter, his valet, was his sergeant in the war, and is familiar with these problems that he has. Sayers refers to it a number of times. "I can't help it," says Whimsy in a fit of depression. "I suppose I've never really been right since the war." Very much there. And war, or the post-war context, has also been identified for the feminization of the detective story. I've already mentioned the predominance of writers and readers. But think just for a moment about some of the detectives. Critics are making a stronger point than who is writing and who's reading. For some of these critics, the detective age in golden age fiction is a new hero, a new kind of hero for the traumatized landscape of post-World War I. Pre-war detectives, Sherlock Holmes and all the others, were emphatically male. The context now required something else. And at one level, there is a feminization of the male detectives. Rotund, sexless Poirot, delicate Whimsy, role-playing Campion and Alain are all removed from the traditional male hero, the man of action, the kind of hero we're going to meet in tomorrow's lecture in hard-boiled fiction. Their methods, too, are different from the scientific rationality of Sherlock Holmes. All the detectives I just mentioned detect as much through empathy and intuition as through detachment and logic. It is a very different version of manliness, argues Alison Light. She's the one who spoke about the convalescence. She says, many of the sleuths of the 1920s and 1930s were self-deprecating amateurs, men who resort to physical violence only in extremis, and whose personal characteristics are likely to include fastidiousness, a narcissistic delicacy, inane giggling, and even laziness. Where Holmes was given to cryptic and sibylline utterances, the new detectives of the 1920s were likely to be garrulous and full of badinage and banalities. Let me leave that there. As we've seen this evening, the puzzle clue, or the clue puzzle, originated and flourished in interwar England. I think one thinks English crime fiction with the clue puzzle, but it's sometimes forgotten that it existed across the Atlantic as well. One practitioner of the form was S.S. Van Dyne. Interestingly, this was the pseudonym of a highbrow art critic who couldn't be seen to be writing these things, so he took a pen name, and he created an amateur detective called Philo Vance, V-A-N-C-E, based in New York. Vance was a dandy, a bon vivant, a man about town. He was supercilious, snobbish, and extraordinarily erudite. He's quite clearly modelled, consciously or unconsciously, I don't know, on Dorothy Sayers' hero. He is Lord Whimsy of Manhattan. and his preening self-regard did not go down at all well with some of his contemporaries. Raymond Chandler growled that Vance is probably the most asinine character in detective fiction. And Ogden Nash wrote a poem about him in which he combines critical appraisal and a means of action. And I'm going to put the entire poem up. A second New York sleuth investigating crimes in classic key puzzle mode was a series by Ellery Queen, another pseudonym featuring another amateur detective, a detective who is also a crime writer, called Ellery Queen. I know it gets a bit self-referential. His father, Ellery Queen's father, was a policeman, a New York policeman, and the typical case sees the young Ellery assisting the older man by picking his way through quite obsessively detailed clues, making his judgments about an unlikely array of suspects, and applying logic and reason. The most famous part of the early Ellery Queen books was a page near the back called Challenge to the Reader. And it says, you've had all the same clues, and it mentions some of them that the detective has, that Ellery Queen has. Can you stop reading now and solve the... A third American clue puzzle writer, I think by far the best, was Rex Stout. I think he's the only one of these who's still read today. His detective was the unforgettable Nero Wolfe. Now, all fictional detectives have some characteristics or eccentricities, but Wolfe had a whole bunch. He's obese. He weighed over 200 kilograms. He's obsessively routine-bound. He's dedicated to his orchids, spending 4 hours a day in a steaming orchard house. And under no circumstances ever will he leave his home, a brownstone on West 35th Street. Any investigation carried out beyond the confines of his home is done by Archie Goodwin, streetwise and witty, Wolfe's living secretary and assistant detective. As Archie Goodwin himself put it, aside from keeping Wolfe awake, I'm chiefly cut out for two things: to jump and grab something before the other guy can get his paws on it, and to collect pieces of the puzzle for Mr. Wolfe to work on. Goodwin narrates all the stories, and he's a worthy successor to John Watson. But the dominance by the clue puzzle in American crime fiction was very short-lived. Its place at the summit of popularity was abruptly ended in the literary equivalent of a coup d'etat. An entirely different type of crime fiction, not deferential towards nor derivative from the British model. A new kind of crime fiction swaggered its way into American popular culture. This was the private eye or hard-boiled detective novel, and is the subject of tomorrow's lecture. Thank you. I'm very happy at each of these lectures to take questions. I know some people need to leave, and I won't feel affronted if they do. But if anybody does have questions or comments, I'd be very glad to take them. Sir. Sorry, Alan, back into here.
On the other hand, she didn't have your picture of the Indian friend, the honorable friend of us, married with a Jewish girl. And it was a very happy marriage. I wonder how strongly you feel that there was that influence.
This is the question of just how anti-Semitic Dorothy Sayers was or was not. She does have one of Whimsy's club friends, Lord Peter Arbuthnot, marry a Jewish woman and apparently live happily ever after.
Freddie
Arbuthnot. I'm not sure to what extent she was responding to criticisms. And I think that may be why not. The first couple of novels are pretty, like, they are overtly anti-Semitic, yeah. Yes. She's always devout. She's always a Christian. She becomes. She writes more and more about the church as she grows older.
Don't you think it's not really anti-Semitism? It's just using certain Jewish characters in London as stereotypes.
Well, I think stereotyping anybody is a form of, othering. And othering is what anti-Semitism or anti-black or anti-gay, anti-women is.
In the story about the girl who poisoned her aunt by injecting her with nothing, she was very pretty anti-black statements.
Yeah. I think what I would say is that it's not untypical of the views of the upper middle class in England between the wars. They were class-bound, anti-Semitic and anti-foreign, and Christie and Sayers reflect that. It's difficult to defend them from it, but I think one just has to understand when they were writing. Yeah. So. That's an interesting. The question is this fiction universally about homicide? There's a whole range of crimes, obviously, but it's murder that tends to be written about. About half the Sherlock Holmes stories were about property, wills, houses, money, and some were about murder, some were about abduction and other things. Stephen Knight has written a critical work where he argues that murder, the body, death, enters crime fiction between the wars, which tends to go with that, the interwar context. But you're absolutely right. Since then, crimes are almost always murder. There are other crimes investigated. I'm going to be talking about Gordy Knight on Wednesday evening, and that's a Dorothy Sayers novel without a murder. I'm just trying to think if there are any of the contemporary South Africa. I think with modern crime stories is that the murder tends to rub shoulders with all sorts of other crimes. I think that's the change. Crime is more diverse. I'll come back to you, sir, at the very...
How do you rate the various TV and movie adaptations of these novels? Do you have a list of favourites? Do you think they do the justice?
The question is how I rate TV and film versions of the Golden Age people. I think David Suchet's Poirot is a wonderfully realized characterization. I can almost put up with all the period piece and the Dr. Hastings for Suchet. I think he's wonderful, but I don't think very, very highly of those. I'm going to be talking a little bit about television and film with relation to the American ones, and in particular, I'm going to make a very extended comparison between the Inspector Morse novels and the Inspector Morse TV series. So I will be coming back to that. I'm not very taken with any of these. I did not like Ian Carmichael as Peter Whimsy, for example. I found him unwatchable. Sir, another question. Am I going to be addressing them? I'm asked if I'm going to be addressing the Scandinavian writers. I'm mentioning them, but really that's all. And I'm in particular going to mention where they came from, a much now less well-known couple who triggered... I'll be talking about that on Thursday night. But there's simply not room to do it all. I mean, I would love to talk about Australian crime fiction, not least because two of the finest Australian crime fiction writers come from South Africa. But that's another story. Malamun and Peter Temple. I think I'm going to thank you all. I will try to make sufficient space at the end of future lectures for questions. Thank you very much.
Dragon Tattoo.
I would call that a crime thriller. I'd call that a crime thriller.
Yes, a crime thriller rather than a detective. But they want to know about this guy,
maybe,
so you're going to tell us.
I'll find a sentence or two. Hi.
Very much as necessary.
Good. Yeah.
One, probably tactless to say it, but half the detective writers lie. They never give you all the clues. They always leave something out. One of the things that I discovered in my discussion with X.
Some are fairer than others.
I put Josephine Tate, Man in the Cube.
Yeah.
The murder was done by a right-handed man. It wasn't. It was done by a left-handed woman.
Yeah.
Which I think...
I think that's naughty. Ronald Knox would have been very cross. Hello. Nice to see you. Whose was?
Carter.
Oh, I didn't know that. Good. So you read them too. I didn't know that Carter read them. We'd have talked about that had I known. Thanks very much indeed. Do you read the contemporary ones, the South Africans? Because that's where I got really interested.
Yes, I like Margaret Alden. Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about her a bit on Friday, right? Nice to see you. Hi. I'm good.
That's good. I wanted to ask you, you know, you were talking about the pre-1918.
Yeah.
And then you were saying later that the murder thing was already entering there. So was that argument that guy's making before it was murder mysteries, not murder mysteries, mysteries about other things?
Yeah. I'm just going to try to find... my handout, my copy of the handout, because the title of his book, Detection, Death, Diversity. And the book's divided into those three sections. That's pre-World War I, that's what we're talking about tonight, and that's the modern one.
Okay, because when you started speaking about it, I just assumed that they were also dead, because I think that's how we
think of
them.
There are some people who get killed in Sherlock Holmes, but not that many.
Yeah.
And mainly crimes against property.
And then the other thing was just that when you're talking about reflecting society and the issues, I just think it's interesting that all of the things are solvable, like you say, and then they restore order. And I think,
you
know,
on a... detective stories that can't solve a crime, or yes. And they're very unsettling,
yeah.
I think.
So, but it's just interesting that during that war period, I would think, you know, there's a lot of confusion about why do so many people die and the morality of it all. And in an individual setting, it's like creating some justice.
Yeah.
In that setting, for that person, we can understand this.
And there's a reason, yeah. There's cause and effect, and there's an outcome. Yeah.
Very reassuring.
Sorry to ask you, have you ever read anything by Emma May? I have some love in that post-war, but Set in Wall Street. And there's two women who write them together.
No, I don't think I've ever read I have read about those, but I've
never read them. They're hard to find. I have to search in my bookshop.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
Okay. No problem.
I'm only going to be using this on Friday.
On Friday again?
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'm just talking.
You just talk.
Okay, okay.
I remember that. Right. Thank you. Yes. I just checked now on my schedule. There's nothing happening here as far as the schedule goes.
Oh, was it other plug that was here?
What other plug?
It was like a...
Maybe that's been hijacked.